This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we welcome National Lawyers Guild leader Jim Lafferty. Jim reflects on his experiences in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and his leadership of the National Lawyers Guild nationally and out in Los Angeles.
We'll talk with author Rebecca Gordon about her book, American Nuremberg, the U.S. officials who should stand trial for post-9/11 war crimes.
In 1945, the United States and its allies, Great Britain, France, and Russia, instituted a war crimes tribunal for the Nazis. 22 were tried, 19 were executed. What's in store for the American war criminals?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Periodically, we feature a segment on Law and Disorder called Lawyers You'll Like. Our guest today is attorney Jim Lafferty. Jim has been a lawyer and a movement activist in Detroit, New York City, and Los Angeles since the mid-60s, when he served as the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. He carried out civil rights work in the Deep South, was one of the national leaders of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and lately has headed up a very successful National Lawyers Guild chapter in Los Angeles. Jim also inspired and still hosts the Lawyers Guild show out in L.A. called the Lawyers Guild Hour. Well, Attorney Jim Lafferty, Heidi and I welcome you back to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's a pleasure always to be with you guys. And hi, Heidi, how are you doing?
I'm well, Jim. Jim, we'd like to start by asking you, how did you decide to become a lawyer?
Well, it's not a terribly dramatic story. I could never shut up in school, literally. My mother probably spent more time at school than I did. And when I was about in the ninth grade, one of my teachers finally looked at me in some despair and said, "You know, Jimmy, you've sure got a good gift for gab. You should probably be a lawyer when you grow up." In a way, it talks about the power of teachers. Nobody in my family ever went to school, ever went to college. Nobody in my family became any profession, of course. I had no idea what lawyers did. And this nice teacher who actually liked me saying that to me got me thinking. And I do credit her in many ways with setting me on the path of becoming a lawyer.
And what was the events that shaped you politically, Jim?
Yeah, well, some of it was as early as high school. I went to an integrated high school in Detroit, and you would have the normal kind of squabbles between people, none of which made sense to me when they were based on race or religion. And so I think, affected by that, affected what was going on in our changing neighborhood, of course. As I got older, and went to college and so forth and began to go to law school, that it was meeting people, frankly, in the National Lawyers Guild. I think we may talk about one of those early cases having to do with George Crockett, who, as you know, was a member of a very famous, I think the first integrated law firm in the country in Detroit, and the inspiration of people like George Crockett, Ernie Goodman, who founded the National Lawyers Guild, reading about Clarence Darrow. I can remember even in high school reading some of Clarence Darrow's summations. His summation, for example, in Leopold Loeb case went on for 12 hours. He had pled them guilty, of course, and he saved them from the death penalty, which nobody thought he could do. And it was that sort of thing. And I suppose seeing Perry Mason on television as a kid, you know, standing up for justice, proving the innocent really were innocent, all of that kind of good stuff resonated.
Jim, when you were in law school, a friend of yours lost custody of her child when she got divorced. Tell us about that case and what you learned from it.
Yeah, that was a pivotal moment in my life, and in some ways in my career, although at the time I didn't think of it as a career matter. A friend of my wife and I at the time was a white nurse. She'd been married to a white school teacher. She had, at that time, a four-year-old daughter. She divorced him. Had fallen in love with a black surgeon, married the black surgeon, and no sooner did she do that than her own mother and her former, white school teacher husband move to change custody from this little girl to themselves, feeling the child shouldn't be raised in an interracial home. This is in Detroit in 1960-61. She came to me knowing I was in law school. What could I do? I asked my law professor what he thought I could do. He recommended the firm of Goodman, Crockett, Eden, Robin, Philo that I mentioned a little bit ago. I went downtown. I met George Crockett, who was a black attorney in Detroit, later a judge in Detroit, later a U.S. congressman and so forth, had himself gone to prison when he defended the Smith Act trials, the trials against so-called communists. And I pled with him very nervously to take my friend's case. And he said he would if, in fact, I would agree to be his clerk and do all the research on it. Interesting aspect of the case, one of my jobs was to read every Supreme Court case in Michigan decided on the matter of custody. And I did. There were something like 103 of them at the time. And in none of those cases, in one case, a woman lost her custody of her daughter because she was a convicted prostitute. In another, it was because she was in a mental hospital. And those were the only two occasions on which a mother with a young daughter lost custody to a father. And in this case, my friend did lose in front of a rather liberal judge, supposedly, in Detroit, did lose custody of little Donna. By that time, Donna was 6 years old. And I can still remember the moment when it fell to me actually to almost have to pull Donna from her mother and turn her over to the people from the court and so forth and so on. It devastated my friend. Some years later, she actually committed suicide. And seeing that kind of naked racism, I think even though I was aware of it by that time, certainly of racism. And also seeing the way in which George Crockett and really that whole firm came together to support this woman and build a little bit of a movement as well around her case was an inspiration to me. And I think then and there I was determined that I was going to do work for justice in whatever vague form that might take.
So you actually were the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild when you got out of law school, the same position that Heidi held for 15 years.
No. Well, yes, you're quite right, yeah.
So, and you went down south. The guild had organized, and under the leadership of Ernie Goodman, a project to go down south and help the civil rights struggle, particularly the voting rights. And you went down there, and you met a woman named Mary Robinson.
Another one of those kind of moments that somehow changed your life. Mary Robinson, when I met her, was about 72 years old, 73 years old. This was part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge. Remember when as a black, you couldn't register, you couldn't vote in Mississippi. So a group got together saying that at the convention that was coming up, they should be seated and not the white delegates from Mississippi. Mary Robinson was going to have her deposition taken as part of this lawsuit, and I was the lawyer who was going to take her deposition. My opponent, in fact, was the Attorney General of Mississippi at the time, who was representing the regular Democratic Party. And Mary lived in a one-room, very, very modest one-room, no indoor plumbing kind of place outside of Jackson, Mississippi. And I asked her how she came to this, and what had happened was she went into Jackson, Mississippi on her 70th birthday to get some supplies. And she said, I saw some white children and colored children, and she said, marching in front of the courthouse. And so I went over and I said, why? What are you kids doing here? Well, we're marching for the right to register and the right to vote. And she said, well, she thought to herself, I've been trying to register and vote for as long as I remember now. So then and there, I joined my first demonstration. That was the first time I'd ever protested. She promptly was arrested and she was thrown in jail. They took her one winter coat. She never got it back. When she got home, her dog was found murdered on her doorstep. Mm-hmm. And literally, a cross was still smoldering on her front lawn. And I asked her, I said, well, what did you make of all that? She said, well, Mr. Laff, she said, I'll tell you. She had a big smile on her face. She said, that was the first day of my life I ever really felt free. Mm-hmm. And she continued after that. Whenever those white children would come down from the north, I'd make sure I had a pie made and a smile on my face because I knew they might be a little frightened and need a friendly face to see. And she continued to be part of the civil rights movement for 8, 9, 10 years until she finally died.
What an inspiration.
Yeah, an inspiration to me. I do think about her often, and she's emblematic of so many African Americans and the fight. I mean, her story is not an uncommon story, and I think that's partly what makes it so inspirational. I mean, she's one of thousands and thousands of people who somehow found that same courage despite having been beaten down for so long.
So the civil rights movement was going on at the same time the anti-war movement started going on against the war in Vietnam. And you came back to Detroit, got active in the anti-war movement. I remember the first time I ever saw your name. You were running for Congress as a Democrat against the war in Vietnam. What do you think brought an end to the war in Vietnam?
Well, it sure as hell wasn't people like me running for Congress. And it wasn't Congress itself. What ended the war in Vietnam is pretty clear to anybody who's looking at an honest history of it. In fact, Johnson and Nixon and McNamara in their memoirs after the war acknowledged that what finally ended the war in Vietnam was, number one, the victory on the battleground of the Vietnamese themselves for their liberation, and number two, the massive, broad movement in the streets in this country of Americans protesting the war week after week, day after day, by the hundreds of thousands. It was that persistent movement. It reached into the GIs themselves. It reached into the military itself. It finally became impossible for any president. Remember, the war in Vietnam ended under Nixon and Ford, hardly men of peace. And it ended then when it did, only because by that time it was impossible for any administration, Democrat or Republican, to carry on the war. And the lesson, I think, that certainly I took away from that, and that I would hope the American people would take away from that, was that it's far more important, frankly, who's marching in the streets than who's sitting in the White House or the Congress if you're really talking about an issue of U.S. imperialism and an issue of that profound importance to the people of this country.
Same lesson you could draw from the civil rights movement.
Same lesson from the civil rights movement. Yeah, absolutely. No, exactly. Lawyers have a role to play. In the Lawyers Guild, one of the things, and Heidi knows this, one of the things we always say in the Lawyers Guild is, yeah, lawyers are important, law students, legal workers, but it's the movement in the streets. If you're trying to bring about social justice and a profound change in social justice in this country, you better have masses of people with you on it. You know, those I sometimes point out, those same nine white men who thought a woman had no right to choose whether or not to terminate a pregnancy changed their mind in Roe versus Wade. Why? Because hundreds of thousands of women and men had marched in the streets and went to jail for the right to have reproductive freedom. So it isn't like they woke up one morning and said, geez, we've been schmucks. I mean, why is it we didn't understand this before? The politics of it made it impossible for the court to do anything but finally recognize what the people demanded.
Jim, as someone who spent decades literally helping protesters in the streets, why did you decide to stop practicing law?
Yeah, that's a fair question. We had a law firm that did all this kind of good law, and so I loved very much that part of it. But I loved the political organizing more. I guess I just came to believe that, as I say, as important as lawyers and law students are, that it was a political movement was more important. Indeed, without it, the lawyers were not going to be of much use. Not in terms of making real change. Oh, you can win a case on an auto accident, and you can... You know, you can litigate a will in a way that turns out the best way you want for your client. But if you're trying to change something as important as a woman's rights or a person of color's rights and gay rights movement, if you're trying to make those kinds of profound changes or certainly change U.S. wars and U.S. foreign policy, what you need more than lawyers, you need people who are prepared to organize masses of people demanding their rights. And I found that more rewarding and seemed to have some facility for it, so I wanted to do it. And it finally took I didn't have time left to practice law after a while.
Jim, I understand that the Red Squad in Detroit kept some files on you in Michigan. Can you describe those?
Yeah, well, sure. It was funny because they kept their file folder on people the same as they kept if you were a burglar or if you were a murderer. Same file folder. They didn't create a different file folder. And, you know, on anybody's police file folder, there's something called... MO, you know, somebody you heard on the television, what's their method of operation? Under mine, it was attorney, which I always thought was kind of funny. And we did. And Dick Sobel, one of our law partners, and himself, I think president of the Lawyers Guild for a time.
Vice president
of the Lawyers Guild for a time. Brought a lawsuit on behalf of myself, my wife, and about 10 other people. It was a class action suit in Detroit, and for a short time, we got the Detroit Police Department to stop doing that. I have no illusions that any of those lawsuits that shut down spying operations, whether it was COINTELPRO of the FBI in the late 60s and early 70s, I have no illusions that those programs didn't start right up again. But you try to keep them honest, and you try to force them to cut back to the extent you can on their intrusion into our First Amendment rights and their effort to shut down our First Amendment rights.
Jim, the Guild has been an important part of the three of our lives for decades, and you, for many, many years, served as the head of the Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles. Can you briefly describe the focus of their work?
Well, Los Angeles, like all American cities, has the same problems. It also has a huge immigration population, and that might make it a little distinct in some ways. It also is one town in America where the union movement is still quite strong. So the Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles has certainly spent a good deal of its time working with the immigrant community and working with the labor movement when they strike. Grocery workers some years back went on a 5-month strike. We were on the picket line with them virtually every day. And again, what the Guild in Los Angeles has learned and what we preach, if you will, to the law students who are in the Guild out there is it's those movements in the street that we represent. And what we're proudest of, I think, in L.A., I think we'd all agree on this, is the fact that we have kept the police at bay. And not only kept them at bay, but frankly forced them through lawsuits and through our legal observing program to back off. And if you're going to have a major political demonstration in this country today, L.A. is probably the best place to do it. And I, because of the work of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles, we've never lost a lawsuit against the police when it came to what our rights were in the streets. And we, at the same time, have developed a decent working relationship. The police have come to understand it saves them money, it saves them aggravation, if, in fact, they will sit down with us as we represent the groups that are preparing for marches and demonstrations and work something out and then not interfere with the rights of the police. I know Michael has been in L.A. and seen that firsthand. It's quite remarkable.
You and Carol Sobel, a wonderful attorney out there, I think you've given the L.A. police PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
I was out there with Debbie a couple months ago, there was a big demonstration of immigrant Latinas when Obama came to town.
That's right.
Because his position has been, he's the greatest deporter of all.
Deporter-in-chief, as they call him.
And a lot of the, they're mostly students, and a lot of them laid down in the middle of the street, and it's major boulevard. And what did the cops do? Nothing.
That's right. Yeah. We've trained our cops out there pretty well, actually. Now don't misunderstand me. You still don't want to be a person of color wandering around L.A. at night.
You could get
shot.
They're
just as vicious as anybody else. But when it comes to exercising your rights as organized protest, we have made some great gains.
Jim, let me get back to your run for Congress as a Democrat in 68. What lessons did you draw from your participation in the Democratic Party?
Well, there were a number of us who ran as so-called peace candidates at that period of time, and that was the reason why I agreed to run. I had not really been that active, certainly in the Democratic Party. I thought of myself as a member of the Democratic Party. I had voted for all the Democrats for office. I sometimes say, and it sounds very glib, but it's true. People will often ask me that question. What was the main lesson you learned, after running for Congress? The main lesson I learned was that it might be possible if you're running Congress to get the no parking sign in front of your street changed if you get a few of your neighbors to support you. But otherwise, you're not going to really make major changes in this country by running for office in that way. It's too much controlled by money. It's too much controlled by corporate America and the corporate oligarchy that run America. The notion that somehow there's enough difference left between these two capitalist parties to matter anymore when it comes to the fundamental direction of this country, whether it's in their foreign policy or even in their domestic policy, Sure, there are differences, but they don't amount to a hell of beans. I mean, that's why under all those years of Clinton and all those years of Obama, we now find ourselves the most economically disproportionately aligned country in the world. You know, you've got 47% of the American people now living below, at, or one paycheck above the official poverty line. That's 150 million Americans, despite, you know, all the supposed gains that we've made. And so you can't expect capitalists to solve the problem for you. And they're capitalist parties. They have a lock on the electoral system in this country. And we need new parties. And until that day comes, the idea of running as a Democrat strikes me as something. And I'm much as I might applaud much of what Bernie Sanders is doing now, or I might applaud many of his positions, I'm unhappy about the fact that he's running in the Democratic Party. It's a capitalist party. It's a party contrary to what he himself claims to believe in, which is a form of democratic socialism. And I think it's miseducating people, because I think you're confusing young people if you tell them that you can somehow take over this capitalist party and turn it into a party of the people. That's not what it was designed to be. That's not what it's going to be. If you want a party of the people, you have to build a party of the people. You can't go into a party that's owned by Shell Oil and all the rest and expect that they're so silly that you're going to let them make it into a party of the people. It's not what it's designed to be, and it won't be that. We need our own party. We need a party of working people and so forth. And I think to the extent that anyone who believes that, who runs as a Democrat or Republican, is miseducating people. Now, if you believe that, if you somehow are willing to settle for some little crumb as the rich continue to get rich and the poor continue to get poor, then I guess you're in the right party. But if you really want to bring about the kind of fundamental change that I think all those wonderful young people in Bernie that are following Bernie Sanders want to do, I think you would you wouldn't want anything to do with either one of those capitalist parties.
But what do you tell people, because you speak frequently in Los Angeles. In fact, you have a weekly radio show, the Lawyers Guild show out mm-hmm. there. You were the inspiration for Heidi and me and Michael Ratner to start this show. Mm-hmm. So you're a public voice in LA. What do you tell people who say, yeah, Jim, that's all very nice, except that now we've got this contest between Trump and Clinton. And is there a difference between the two? What is the difference? Should we vote? Should we not vote? What should we do? What kind of what have you been talking about on your show about what to do with this dilemma that's facing everybody?
We're in fact, KPFK is going to in fact do a two-hour show where we bring on all the socialist candidates and talk about those alternatives. What we talk about on our show and what we talk about with our law students and out of there is the same thing I've just been saying here, that this it's understandable if you look at somebody like a Trump. And that, by God, anything is better than Trump. It's that old lesser evil politics that we've been hearing about forever. The trouble is, it's an aesthetic more than it's a reality, because the president doesn't run the country in that sense anyway. You've got a Congress, which is still going to be the Congress in there. Yes, the president can do great harm. Yes, he can get us into wars and so forth and so on. Oh, hell, Obama's the first president in history, a Democrat, first president in history who spent 8 years at war. That happened to no other president. So the notion that somehow, first of all, you know who you're really electing and that you know they're going to be what they say they're going to be. Obama was going to be the man of peace, after all, and instead he's become he's the war president of American history at this point. And let's hope nobody it's hard to do more than that. So what we try to explain to people is it's a long haul. It's tempting to say Trump is so much worse than Clinton, well, you might as well vote for Clinton. But as long as that's all you do, you will never move things forward. You might slow the decline of this country a bit. I sometimes put it this way, if I can, really, really quickly. There are two boats. There's the Democratic Party boat and the Republican Party boat, and they're both out there in the lake. They both have leaks in them. I agree. And I'll even admit the Republican Party boat has more leaks in it than the Democrat. Stay in either one of those boats, you will drown. And that's essentially what we've been doing in this country. The gap between rich and poor, all the rest, the climate is getting worse and worse. All that continues whether we elect a Democrat or a Republican. Does it sometimes happen a little more? Does the bad sometimes happen a little more slowly under a Democrat than a Republican? Yeah, but we're still approaching the cliff. We're still going to go off into the abyss. the abyss of barbarism, and the abyss of a climate and a planet you can't live on, the abyss of people who are so poor they can't survive. So unless we're willing to abandon that and get about the business of building a real people's movement and a real people's party, all we'll ever be able to do is vote for the lesser of two evils and still find ourselves surrounded with growing evil.
Well, I'm not even sure that I would define it as the lesser of two evils. One facilitates evil easier than the next, I would say.
Yeah, I like that. That's right. One it happens more easily under one than the other.
Jim, one of the great jurists in American history was Oliver Wendell Holmes. I mean, he had fought in the Civil War, and he lived all the way up and was on the Supreme Court of the United States through the 20s, and a much admired figure in American history. And Justice Holmes, the great jurist, gave advice to people, and he said something about how people need to participate in the actions and the passions of their own times to truly live. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to expand on that thought.
Well, I think it's true. I think and I'm so excited when I see the young lawyers today in Los Angeles, in New York, all over the country when I meet the young lawyers, not just in the Lawyers Guild, but young lawyers, because there's an understanding that unless you want to be in the position of a child versus the parent government, in other words, unless you want to just let this government go and do whatever it's going to do, oh, I'm powerless, I can't, what can I possibly do, how can I fight City Hall, these powerful corporate forces you're talking about, Jim, they're too strong for us. No, they're not. And Andre Roy says, we be many, they be few. And if you do, and if you are willing to engage in the actions and passions, not only will you feel an adult, like an adult, not only will you feel fulfilled, will you feel like a full human being, but you can win. I mean, that's sort of the story of history. That's the story of the civil rights movement. That's the story of the women's movement. That's the story of the gay rights movement. That's the story of the anti-war movement, the labor movement. When people said, yeah, we can fight City Hall, but you can't do that by just signing a petition online. You can't do this by just voting, certainly. You can only do this if you really take the notion that I've got to be a part of the actions and passions of my time. And what is that today? Well, it's the climate, it's economic justice, it's whatever the issue is in your community. And I'm going to be a part of that. And I'm going to find other people who are a part of that. And when you do it, you feel great, first of all. You feel real good. you feel, as I say, adult. You feel like a full human being, win or lose. And in the short run, you'll lose more times before you'll win. But I guess it was Martin Luther King, the arc of justice. Yeah, yeah. As the famous Martin Luther King said, I don't know, but it works. But he's right. He was right about that. I think you have to have that view. There's no guarantee. He could be wrong. But wouldn't you rather go down that road? Wouldn't you rather struggle? Wouldn't you rather assume that the arc of justice is long but finally meets the pot of gold than that it doesn't?
The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice.
I think that's it.
Well, that's a good thought to end on.
It is indeed.
Jim Lafferty, just a pleasure to be with you.
Always with you, folks.
And have you here in New York and to have you as a guest on Law and Disorder. Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you, guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
World War II started on September 1st, 1939, when fascist Germany attacked its neighbor Czechoslovakia. By the end of the war, 6 years later, some 80 million people had died and the continent of Europe lay wasted. The first trials of 22 Nazi leaders, generals, and bankers was organized by the victorious allies, the United States, Britain, Russia, and France. It took place in Nuremberg, Germany. 19 Nazis were found guilty and executed. Robert H. Jackson, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court and Chief Prosecutor for the United States at Nuremberg, wrote that, "We must not forget that the record on which we judge the defendants today is a record in which we will be judged tomorrow." Intentional war is the greatest of all crimes because it contains within it all the rest of the horrible crimes. The United States of America's intentional war against Iraq, which was motivated to the public with lies about weapons of mass destruction, and which has since spread to six other countries in the Middle East, has resulted in over 1 million deaths, driven millions more from their homes, and destroyed ancient peoples and their cultures. The United States helped establish the international principles that guided the prosecution of war crimes when Nazi officials were held accountable for their crimes against humanity. But the American government and its legal system have consistently refused to apply the same principles to our own officials. In her book, American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes, Rebecca Gordon indicts the officials who, in a just society, should be put on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. She acknowledges that the U.S. government is unlikely to do this and proposes an alternative based on the Russell tribunals held in 1967, exposing America's criminality in the war against Vietnam. Rebecca Gordon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's an excellent book, American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Rebecca, the title of your book, American Nuremberg, why'd you choose that title? Are the Nuremberg tribunals still relevant today?
That's a really good question. To be perfectly honest, I didn't choose the title. It was offered to me with the request that I write the book. And in the beginning, I was a little uncomfortable about it just because I grew up in the shadow of World War II and the Holocaust, and I wanted to be careful not in any way to suggest that, horrible as they are, the crimes that have been committed in this so-called war on terror in any way approach the level of the horror that took upwards of 85 million lives in the middle of the 20th century. But Nuremberg itself, what was achieved at Nuremberg, is absolutely crucial today because it was really the first time in history that a group of nations came together and said that on an international level, in an orderly, organized, and legitimate way, we are going to put on trial people who are responsible for terrible crimes in a venue, because there was no international venue until Nuremberg in which that could be done. And so I think it's still relevant to this very day because we still live in a world in which there are nations whose leaders can commit crimes with impunity, terrible crimes, and there is no relevant place where they can be tried if those officials are the heads of government in the United States of America. There is a venue in which many, many people could be tried, and it's called the International Criminal Court. Sadly, the United States is not party to the convention which created that court. And I can talk a little bit about the history of why, because it happened during the Bush administration.
Yes, exactly. I'd like to do that because there are 116 other countries in the world that have signed on, and the United States won't do it. But for those of us who don't know, let's talk a bit about what constitutes a war crime. Is there an international standard or an American standard? Are these standards that all countries are supposed to abide by?
Yes, yes, and yes. So there are international standards for how wars are supposed to be carried out, and there are sort of two strains of those standards. There are the ones that are written down, and there are the ones that are called the customs of war. So together, these are called the laws and customs of war. And the international standard is created by a series of treaties, and these treaties actually go back to the 19th century. The 20th century saw a number of important treaties, and I won't bore your listeners with the whole list, but some of the key ones that you hear about a lot are the 1949 Geneva Conventions. And those are the latest version of the set of rules that were created in the 19th century for how people who are caught up in a war ought to be treated. And they include things like protections for healthcare workers, protections for journalists, protections for civilians, and crucially, in the case of the Bush administration's treatment of people it picked up during this so-called war, for the protection of people who become prisoners in the context of a war. So there are all those rules. Then there are also rules about how a war can be initiated in the first place. And so one of the key issues that actually Great Britain and the United States brought into the Nuremberg Tribunal was the idea that the very first crime, the initial crime of the Nazi regime, was actually the crime of making an unjust, unprovoked war in the first place, what they called a crime against peace or making an aggressive war. And it is true in the long customs of war, the long history of war, and also in very specific treaties such as the 1928 Kellogg-Briand Treaty and also the Charter of the United Nations, that it is absolutely against the law of war to attack a nation which has not already attacked you or is not on the very imminent point of attacking you. And so in American Nuremberg, one of the things that I argue is that the besetting crime of the Bush administration is one that we think of often nowadays, almost everyone is stumbling over themselves to say it was a mistake. But I'm going to argue it was also illegal, and that is the unprovoked attack on the nation of Iraq. And you might think, well, how did the torture have anything to do with that? How did these other things have anything to do with that? But in fact, the very first use of torture on people who had been detained, who had been picked up in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan and were tortured either by the CIA or sent to Guantanamo and tortured either before they got there or after they got there, what they were trying to get those people to say is that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and September 11th, that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. That connection did not exist. But when you waterboard somebody 83 times in a row, chances are he will tell you anything you want to hear. And so my argument is that that's one of the key crimes. Then one of the other really important distinctions that you're supposed to make once you've entered a war is the distinction between civilians and combatants. And repeatedly, sadly, in the conduct of the war, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and also in the use of drones for assassinations, the United States has repeatedly failed to distinguish between civilians and combatants, and failing to distinguish means killing them.
Trump, who just might get elected as the next president of the United States, Trump has said that he promises to commit more human rights violations. He wanted to bring back waterboarding and other torture programs. That's okay with him. Mm-hmm. And what kind of message does this send out to our enemies?
Well, okay, if you want to take a purely instrumental view of it, it says do whatever you want to captured Americans because we're going to do whatever we want to you. But beyond that, it also says not only to our enemies, but to our friends and to neutral countries around the world, this is a nation that does not respect the rule of law. This is, in effect, a rogue nation. And that is a very terrifying message for the rest of the world to hear, because the United States is the country with the biggest economy in the world, the country with the most powerful military in the world, the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, which we're in the middle of revamping, and with an archipelago of bases, military bases spread out all over the world. And for the rest of the world to hear, this is a country that can operate with complete impunity, that can on the world stage, brag about the war crimes we haven't even yet committed, but we're prepared to do. And it goes beyond torture. One of the other things that Donald Trump has said is that he thinks we need to murder the families of people he calls terrorists. So he's not only saying that we need to capture and bring to trial people who have actually committed crimes. He's saying that the only way we can get their attention, whatever that means, is to kill their families. Well, that is not only a war crime if there's an actual war going on, it's plain old straight-up murder. It is illegal under federal law, international law, and it's just plain wrong.
Well, what about the drone strikes that are being conducted under the President Obama administration? How would you categorize them?
Sadly, they are also examples of terrible crimes. I don't call them war crimes for sort of a technical reason, but it's kind of an important reason, which is that a war is not a metaphor. A war is an actual ongoing heavy conflict between armed forces, between armies. What the United States is doing in places like Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan, when the war isn't going on, where we are targeting individual human beings with remotely piloted strikes, where the pilots are actually sitting in a container somewhere in Nevada, those are murders, those are assassinations, and they are violations of human rights. They are not actually war crimes because there's the U.S. is not actually fighting a war, although we're assisting a war in Yemen. We're not actually fighting a war in Pakistan. But what we are doing is, on a weekly basis, and, you know, this has appeared in the New York Times. I don't know if it's still going on, but President Obama meets weekly on Tuesdays and goes over the list of people to be murdered remotely from Nevada and approves them.
Those are called Terror Tuesdays in the White House. But Obama has said, with respect to prosecuting Bush and Cheney and the other criminals during the war against Iraq, he said he won't do that, he says, because we have to look forward, not backward. Do you think that this has encouraged illegal activity?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. It's, you know, it's a very sad thing. This is what he said really the day after he took office. He took office and he immediately put in place executive orders that ended what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques, what the rest of the world calls torture, and that told the CIA to close down their so-called dark sites where they were holding detainees and torturing them. And my personal guess, and I have no evidence for this, but it seems logical to me, is that this was that not going forward with prosecutions was the quid pro quo, the exchange that Obama made in order to get the CIA to actually obey his executive order. Because I think one of the things that he discovered very early on in his presidency is that there are limits to the power even of the President of the United States, and especially if that president happens to be a black man. And so my guess is that this was a quid pro quo. But regardless, the effect has been that the people who were responsible for torture in the past can act with complete impunity. And then we also have the effect that the people running for president on the Republican ticket have been campaigning against each other, promising to commit more and worse war crimes. Ted Cruz, who just dropped out of the race, he was campaigning on a promise to find out whether or not sand can glow in the dark. In other words, threatening to use nuclear weapons against a force, well, against anyone, but against a force that is largely a guerrilla force. And if there had been any kind of consequences for the people in the Bush administration who carried out these terrible crimes, we would not now see that these ideas have been solidified in public opinion as legitimate stances, as a legitimate thing to promise to do. And this is, to me, the worst of it. It's not just that the individuals haven't been held accountable, but that what it creates in this country is a sense that the things that we did under the Bush administration and the continuing drone attacks today are maybe a little ugly, but ultimately they were necessary in order to protect the citizens of the United States. And this is just plain factually wrong and morally wrong. And unfortunately, the responsibility for that lies to a certain extent at President Obama's feet. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's true.
No, I think the majority of people in this country would support torture, and that's the problem, and that's, I think, why no one's been held accountable for it. But why do you maintain that the first essential step in achieving justice for victims of human rights crimes is the public acknowledgement that the crimes have been committed?
That's a really good question, and the reason I say that is a result of my conversations with people who work with the victims of these kinds of crimes. And, for example, a friend of mine, Almudena Bernabeu, who works at the Center for Justice and Accountability, when I proposed this to her, said, yes, that's exactly it. Because really the first step in justice is to say that something wrong has been done. And this is another problem that until very recently the victims of crime of these kinds of crimes have had with the United States, which is not only have there not been prosecutions, but they have also been stopped. They've been stymied if they try to bring suit in civil court in the United States for the things that were done to them. And so this is in the UN Convention Against Torture, which the United States has signed and ratified, and people may not know this, but the sixth article of our Constitution says anytime the Senate ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of the supreme law of the land. So that convention is U.S. federal law. And in that convention, one of the things that it says is that people who have been victims of torture have a right to sue for remedies, to be made whole, for reparation. And until very, very recently, the Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, have gone into federal court and have said, we cannot allow these suits to go forward for reasons of national security. That actually changed for the first time ever a couple of weeks ago when, for the first time in district court, Washington District Court, the Obama administration signaled that they were not going to use this national security claim to prevent a suit from going forward from somebody who has recently been released from Guantanamo. So this is the first crack. But if we can't even tell the story in some official way so that people can hear it, recognize what was done with them, done to them, we really haven't begun the very first step in justice. And we were talking a little while ago, you and I, about the process in South Africa after the end of the apartheid government, and how important that process of truth and reconciliation was. And the very first step in that process, the thing that made it so effective, was that people got to tell the stories of what had happened to them in a context in which the rest of the country was actually listening to them for the first time. And that is so crucial, just because so much of the experience of torture is the experience of having your world literally torn apart so that your physical, emotional, and sensible world are completely destroyed. And this is done in a number of ways, which I've actually talked about in an earlier book called Mainstreaming Torture. But the effect of it is that you very often no longer have a clear sense of your own history, your own experience, and you lose your connections with all of the social networks that you had before you were tortured, especially if, as many torture regimes do, you are tortured and then set loose on the street so that people can see what was done to you and you become a warning to other people. The very first step in healing, really the very first step in justice, is to have that story told and accepted in some publicly recognized venue.
I don't think that that story is going to be told in any official venue in the United States. I remember Robert Jackson, who was the associate justice on the American Supreme Court,
right.
And he was the first prosecutor at Nuremberg.
That's right.
He said, "We must not forget that the record on which we judge the defendants today is the record of which we will be judged tomorrow." Well, that's not going to happen here, I don't think. So alternatively to having the United States government actually take responsibility for prosecuting these war criminals, perhaps there's a way to do it outside of a government structure. And I think we have an example of that in the Bertrand Russell War Crimes Tribunal that took place in 1967 during America's war in Vietnam. And I wanted to ask you if that has any relevance to what we might be working for today here in the United States.
I think it does, actually. Sadly, I agree with you that the possibility that we're going to see actual prosecution in the United States is remote, even more remote than the possibility that Donald Trump would be the Republican candidate. And we need to look at another possibility. So you mentioned the Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre tribunals that took place in Europe in 1967. And what they did was they assembled really the stars primarily of the intellectual and literary world. So there were people like James Baldwin, extraordinary people who took part in those tribunals. What I think we might consider doing is bringing together as many people who really have the expertise to put together a people's tribunal. And there are ways in which we could even improve on what was done in 1967. In 1967, the questions considered were almost a little bit tendentious, because the questions were, have terrible things been done? Was this particular bombing a war crime? Was this? And I think that we could even step back a little bit and simply start with a presentation of the evidence. And what I would like to see is a group of people that includes the voices of the actual victims of war crimes, and I'm in touch with some people who have talked about being able to bring those voices into such a tribunal. I'd like to see legal experts, the very people who've been involved in trying, for example, to bring habeas corpus cases for people who have been held in Guantanamo. I'd like to see present day and past members of Congress, people who have been public officials, people with a lot of credibility in the world, bring together a real tribunal, more along the lines of Nuremberg in terms of rules of evidence and presentation of evidence. I think it would take a year or two to actually do the planning to make something like this as real and as powerful as it could be. But I think if we're not going to get an official government record of what happened, that we really need to do everything we can to present a people's record and to put that information into the public record so that historians in the future, for example, will have not only the record of the Senate, the 500-page executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on torture, but will have a broader, wider record that considers not only what the CIA did, but what a number of other agencies have done, and, you know, the larger crimes of making war that was illegal. That's what I would like to see, and I would love to collaborate on that, because I think we still have an opportunity. The window has not closed. The people who are responsible and the people who lived through these things are still with us and are still living, and we need to capture that history now so that at least there is one loud voice saying there cannot be crimes committed over and over and over again without any public consequence at all.
We've been speaking with Professor Rebecca Gordon. Her book, American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. Rebecca, it's an excellent book. I urge our listeners to get it. And I thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
You take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Of uncertainty, I want to be in the warm hold of your loving to feel you all around me, and to take your hand along the sand. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I'd look, your eyes I'd find. For me to love you now would be the sweetest thing. 'Twould make me sing. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. All my blues behind. For standing in your heart is where I want to be and long to be.